and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Alaska World Affairs Council for Dr. Trita Parsi's talk on Obama's diplomacy with Iran. President of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, Dr. Parsi was recorded speaking in Anchorage on Friday, February 10th.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, everyone. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm the CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's such a pleasure to see so many people here today. Please excuse the little shuffle. We are bringing out some more chairs. And thank you for coming. If you could please RSVP next time, that will help us manage our numbers and make sure we have enough seats and food for everyone. This time I'd like to introduce the head table. At my far left, I have Steve Zelliner, a member of the Alaska World Affairs Council Board. And to his right, Mr. Garrett Wong, who is the chairman of our board of directors this year. And to his right, Flip Todd, who's also another member of our board. And he will be coming to the podium to introduce our speaker. Flip.
Thank you very much, Lisa. It's my pleasure today to introduce a man I've been trying for more than 2 years to bring to the Alaska World Affairs Council, Professor Trita Parsi, who holds a PhD in Israeli-Iranian relations from Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Relations. He came to my attention when I saw him interviewed on C-SPAN's Book TV, which I commend to all of you, discussing his first book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. I've never found an author who didn't like having his book held up. Is that okay? Last month, Yale University Press published his second book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, which discusses the previously untold story of American-Iranian negotiations early in the Obama administration. He describes the efforts as having to work immediately or it wouldn't be pursued at all. The single roll of the dice, following the Bush administration's persistent refusal to negotiate with Iran at all. In 2002, Dr. Parsi founded the National Iranian American Council to, and I quote, enable Iranian Americans to condemn the September 11, 2001 attacks on the U.S. and to strengthen the voice of Iranian Americans. A native of Iran, he was born into a Zoroastrian family that moved to Sweden when he was four to escape the political repression of the Ayatollah Khomeini's Islamic Republic. His father was an outspoken academic who had previously been jailed when the Shah was in power. Dr. Parsi holds master's degrees in international relations from Sweden's Uppsala University and in economics from the Stockholm School of Economics. He has served as an adjunct professor of international relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, as an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute, and policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. His articles on the Middle East have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Britain's Financial Times, Jane's Intelligence Review, The Nation, The American Conservative, The Jerusalem Post, and The Forward. He has appeared on several occasions on PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, National Public Radio, the BBC, the BBC's little brother, Al Jazeera, and CNN. I don't know if you know, but many of the people at Al Jazeera actually came from BBC when they started it up. In 2010, he won the University of Louisville's Grommeier Award for ideas improving world order, a $200,000 prize which had previously been won by Mikhail Gorbachev of the Soviet Union, Harvard historian Samuel Huntington, and Australian Foreign Minister Gareth Evans. Not bad company. Former U.S. National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who spoke at this podium a few years ago, and helped supervise Dr. Parsi's PhD dissertation, described his first book as, quote, an insightful and well-researched effort of high intellectual caliber. And bringing events more up to date, I noticed when researching our speaker's recent public comments that when CNN asked him who assassinated Mostafa Ahmadi Rashan, an official at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment plant last month, he responded, and I quote, most likely contender among people who are following this is that the Israelis are doing it, possibly in cooperation with the Iranian Mujahideen. You can ask him to expand on that if you wish during the question and answer session. He gave me a brief update on that at lunch today. Dr. Parsi is fluent in Farsi, the predominant language in Iran, as well as Swedish, and as you will soon hear, in American English. Will you please welcome, as our speaker, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much. It's a great, great pleasure being here. This is my first visit to Alaska, and I've been just floored by the beauty. If you see me during this speech, perhaps glaze off looking at the mountains, it's not because I'm bored by my own presentation. It's like because I'm truly floored by the beauty of this state. I have to warn you, however, I am going to talk to you about a rather gloomy subject. It's actually quite depressive. You're not going to walk away from this talk feeling more happy. If you're already suffering from depression, do feel free to leave now. I won't feel insulted or hurt, but I want to give you that warning because this is a story of unfortunate failures of statecraft, and we are now 3 years into the Obama administration, probably closer to a potential military confrontation than we ever have been. So let me first explain why I wrote this book. I had followed U.S.-Iran relations for quite some time. I'd written my dissertation on Israel and Iran and the interaction with the U.S. And I was quite intrigued by President Obama's election victory and the promise he had made to pursue diplomacy. I was called into the White House a few times during the summer of 2009 to advise them on how to handle the situation with the uprisings and the election protests in Iran. And afterwards, I felt it would be really interesting to write a book that would try to bring together a comprehensive view of what happened. How did this diplomacy take place? What were the calculations? And not just the calculations of the Obama administration, but try to bring into the mix as many of the key actors as possible. So I interviewed several folks from the Obama administration. I interviewed the Iranian negotiators. I interviewed Israeli officials, Saudi officials, the Europeans, the Turks, the Brazilians, every state that had a finger in this, I tried to talk to get their perspectives, to get a comprehensive picture of what has been happening in the last 3 years. So let me start off by giving you a quote from President Obama. To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward, based on mutual interest and mutual respect. To those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent, know that you are on the wrong side of history, but that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist. Only 12 and a half minutes into Obama's presidency, he reaches out to the Iranians, offering them America's hand of friendship if they were to unclench their fists. This was a bold move, but it wasn't a move born out of desire, but rather out of necessity. To the best of our knowledge, Obama did not grow up having any childhood dreams about negotiating with the Ayatollahs. This came around as a result of the geopolitical developments that had happened in the region in the course of the past years, primarily the invasion of Iraq and some of the mistakes that the Bush administration had committed. While some would make the argument that President Bush started a war of option, for Obama, negotiating with Iran increasingly appeared to be seen by himself as a piece of necessity. The Bush administration pursued an ideological foreign policy. One of its tenets was that you do not talk to your enemies. You do not talk to states that have bad relations with the United States, because by talking to them, you may strengthen them. You may bring them legitimacy. And as a result, the United States should only pursue diplomacy with the states that deserve America's company. Now, whatever one's view may be of that philosophy and that foreign policy outlook, the bottom line effect, its track record over the last 8 years, in the case of Iran in particular, was quite clear. From the time that the Bush administration entered office until they left, between 2000 and 2008, Iran went from having probably less than 50 centrifuges to about 8,000 centrifuges by 2008. While Iran was cornered by a hostile regime in Iraq and a hostile regime in Afghanistan, the Taliban and Saddam Hussein's regime, by the end of the invasions of these two states and the developments there, Iran ended up becoming the kingmaker of the political order of those two states. It expanded its influence in Lebanon, throughout the region, and because of its very vocal and at times aggressive rhetorical position against the United and increasingly unpopular United States in the region, its basis for soft power also increased throughout this period. Against this backdrop, you have candidate Obama emerging and doing something that was completely unprecedented. In the 08 elections, as a central part of his foreign policy platform, he puts the idea that we should have negotiations with many of the states that the United States traditionally had had bad relations with or had shunned. And something that under normal circumstances would have been political suicide, in 08 became a winning card for his presidential bid. Because the climate in Washington, D.C. had changed dramatically. You had had five former secretaries of state coming out, arguing in favor of diplomacy with Tehran. You had the Iraq Study Group saying that in order to be able to get out of Iraq in a reasonable fashion, in order to succeed there, we do need to engage the neighboring states through diplomacy, particularly Iran and Syria. So a political opening, a window had been created in which the population in the United States had rejected the underlying philosophy of the Bush administration's philosophy on foreign policy. But administration of Obama knew that time was short. This unprecedented window would probably close within 12 months or so. And there was constant pressure from the very outset because, first of all, the Iranians were continuing with their nuclear program. They were amassing more and more low-enriched uranium, LEU. And you can use low-enriched uranium to build nuclear weapons. There was pressure from friendly states, allies of the United States, such as Israel and Saudi Arabia, who were fearful that in a negotiation between the United States and Iran, a deal would be struck that would come at the expense of their security interests. There was also pressure from some of the European states. Most of them were quite pleased to see Obama's new approach. But there were also some concerns, particularly in France, that Obama would be so eager to strike a deal with Tehran that he would change the red lines of the West. And of course, above Obama hang throughout this period the potential threat that Israel would take preventive military action against Iran's nuclear facilities, a move that the US military throughout the Bush administration had opposed and continues to oppose, believing that it would bring more negatives than positives. Of all of America's major allies, many wished Obama well, but very few actually wished him success. And after 30 years of enmity, Obama also knew that tackling a 30-year-old, I would call it an institutionalized enmity, is going to be tremendously difficult. One of the first things Obama tried to do was to increase the likelihood that diplomacy even could take place. After 30 years of institutionalized enmity, both Iran and the United States were consistently, almost reflexively, using a very aggressive language against each other. The Iranians were calling the United States the Great Satan at every Friday prayer. anti-American rhetoric coming out of Iran was essentially part of the normal order. The Bush administration had put Iran in the axis of evil. There had been 30 years of mutual demonization. One of the first things the Obama administration tries to do is to change the language in order to create an atmosphere that was more conducive to the success of diplomacy. To give you one example, candidate Obama had on several occasions in interviews used a term that we will negotiate using carrots and sticks, which is a very common term here in the United States. It's not meant in any negative fashion. But the term translates tremendously badly into Persian. It essentially means that Iran is a donkey and we're going to hit it with a stick or bribe it with a carrot. As the State Department became aware of how this actually sounded to the Iranians, within 2 weeks, this term was eliminated, terminated from the State Department's terminology, vocabulary, and talking points. Until this day, I've actually not come across a single senior or even junior official using that term in regards to Iran. I view that as an indication of the Obama administration's seriousness in trying to change the language. The most stark example of that, however, is the March message, New Year message that President Obama tapes and airs on VOA and through the internet. In March, the Iranians have their New Year. And on the eve of that, a 3.5-minute video message was taped by Obama, in which he addresses both the people of Iran and the government, talks about the need of resolving their problems, saying that the many problems that exist between the United States and Iran cannot be resolved through threats, which was a clear indication of him trying to depart away from the primary instrument used by the Bush administration. Talks about the need of bringing Iran back into the community of nations. At the end, he even quotes a very famous Persian poet, all aimed at creating a different atmosphere. Now, the Iranian response to this message was very swift. Within a day, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, who was the final decision maker in Iran, an Ayatollah, gives a speech in his hometown of Mashhad. He spends approximately the first 40 minutes of that speech complaining about everything the Iranians believe the United States have committed as a sin against the Iranians. Towards the end of this long, long laundry list of complaints, he gives a very, very small opening, saying that the administration, that the Iranians don't have any experience with this new administration. It doesn't carry the same baggage as the previous ones did. On the one hand, they're skeptical. They don't know whether Obama can change a policy of 30 years. Saying that we don't know who makes the decisions in the United States. Is it Congress? Is it the president? Or are there other forces behind the shadows? But then saying, if you change, we change. Indicating to the United States that if there is a change in substance, in policy, the Iranians would reciprocate. But it's coming after a long, long barrage of complaints and the usual very, very tiresome negative rhetoric against the United States. 3 months of that 12 months had already passed, and all the Obama administration had been able to do is to put its folks into the right offices, do a review of the policy, and now by April, finally, they had decided on what type of a strategy to use, and the question was, when do we start the diplomacy? And the decision was made not to talk to the Iranians prior to their June presidential elections, out of a fear that potentially this could tilt the elections in favor of Ahmadinejad, which obviously from the U.S. perspective would not be particularly desirable. So another 2 months is gone, waiting for the Iranians to come out of their political season, and their elections were held on June 12, 2009. The expectation in Washington was that whoever wins, there will be some clarity on June 13th. And by that clarity, some negotiations could probably start by July or so. It would give the Obama administration 6 months to try to do something constructive. What they did not expect, that by June 13th, there would be nothing resembling clarity. Because there were massive fraud in the elections, followed by huge demonstrations against the Iranian government, and massive human rights abuses taking place in front of the cameras of the world. Everyone could see it, and I'm sure many of you here in this room saw those abuses on your CNN screens. And this created a major problem for the Obama administration. Now, let me give you just a parenthesis. I'm not going to go into any details as to whether this was a fraudulent election or not, but let me give you a couple of examples to just demonstrate the point. The morning of election day, Mousavi, the main contender against Ahmadinejad, he had two headquarters in Tehran. One of them is attacked by, I believe, 10 to 12 security officials on the pretext that there's a TV studio inside a building somewhere that didn't have a license. A fist fight breaks out. The volunteers at the office actually wrestle down these security officials, tie them down, and lock them in the basement of the building. They call Iran's head of the judiciary, who tells them, well, call the police will handle it. The police comes, they bring out these guys out on the streets to give them to the police. The police releases them on the spot and they disappear into the crowd. 2 hours later, they're back with reinforcement. This time, they couldn't be wrestled down. They arrest the first and second circle of all of the top advisors of Mousavi and Karoubi, the other major contender against Ahmadinejad. Moreover, by early evening, Iranian TV announces that Ahmadinejad has won a landslide victory of 62.5% or 63%. That's quite a feat, mindful of the fact. Now, I'm not saying that the Iranians are as incompetent as Florida when it comes to counting votes, but we're talking about counting 40 million handwritten votes within a day and actually managing to count them before all of the votes have been cast because the polls were still open. That's a measurement of efficiency that I don't think we ever will have here, fortunately. But this created a major problem for the administration. It was a major blow because more time was now lost, because Iran was in political chaos. The elite was essentially at war with itself. An elite that is at war with itself cannot conduct foreign policy, and it certainly cannot negotiate with the United States the key foreign policy problem that the Iranians had. Moreover, this was also a blow to the moral confidence of the administration that pursuing negotiations was the right track. But something had happened just 10 days before the elections that had given the administration a sense that there was a decent prospect, a decent chance of succeeding with the negotiations. On June 2nd, 2009, the Iranians send a letter to the head of the IAEA, International Atomic Energy, in Vienna, El Baradei, saying that they're running out of fuel for their reactor in Tehran, the Tehran Research Reactor, which was given to the Iranians back in the 60s or 70s from the United States. It's a reactor that is being used to produce medical isotopes for approximately 850 to 900,000 Iranian cancer and other forms of patients. The Iranians were running out of fuel and they wanted to buy it. On the normal procedure, El Baradei should have taken that request and sent it on to all of the potential sellers in the international energy market. He didn't do that because he saw the opportunity. He informs only the Russians and the United States. And the Obama administration immediately realizes that this is quite an opening because they had spent several weeks trying to figure out what can they do to get the Iranians to give up the low enriched uranium that they had stockpiled. As I mentioned earlier on, that was one of the indicators that would show how far or how close the Iranians would be to potential breakout and actually building a bomb. If you can get the count to go down significantly, 1,200 kilos is what you would approximately need theoretically to be able to build a bomb. If you could keep the count low consistently, then that would reduce the breakout capability and Obama would win time and political space to pursue a larger negotiation. But instead of trying to find a way to get the Iranians to give up the LEU, now the Iranians were asking to buy fuel pads, and an idea came up, saying, well, instead of selling them the fuel pads, why don't we take their low-enriched uranium, turn it into fuel pads, and give it back to them? That way, they get the fuel pads, that's what they wanted, and we'll reduce their LEU count so that we don't have to worry about a potential Iranian breakout towards a nuclear weapon. Seems pretty straightforward. Problem was, now you had election chaos and didn't know exactly how to start this. But by September, the administration's patience was running out. There was no clarity as to when there would be clarity in Iran's political scene. One could wait 6 months, one could wait a year. And the administration only had till end of December to try to do something according to their own calculation of how the political landscape looked like in D.C. So by September, they send a message to the Iranians saying they want to meet with the P5 plus one, the permanent members of the Security Council in Germany, to discuss a proposal. The Iranians accept. And for the first time, October 1st, 2009, in Geneva, there is a meeting between the Security Council and Iran in which the U.S. is a full participant. Prior to that, the U.S. had either not shown up or, in one occasion, they had sent Undersecretary Bill Burns to sit in the room but not say a word. But now the U.S. was a full participant in the negotiations. The proposal was presented to the Iranians, an idea that there would be a fuel swap. The Iranians accepted in principle, and most of the afternoon of October 1st was actually spent on negotiating the press release that would be issued about what happened at the meeting itself. That's what most of the diplomacy ended up being about. The agreement is that within a couple of weeks there would be a second meeting at the technical level in which the details of this would be handled out. On October 19th, they meet now in Vienna, and they present the details of the proposal to the Iranians. The details were, the Iranians at the time had 1,500 kilos of LEU. We wanted them to give up 1,200 kilos in one shipment that would be sent first to Russia. The Russians would reprocess it to 19.75% enriched uranium, send it on to France. The French would turn it into fuel pads, and about a year later, the Iranians would get their fuel pads. At this point, the Iranians essentially say, uh-uh, not a chance. Who invited the French to this party? First day in the negotiations is being spent on trying to cut the French out of the deal. The Iranians had very bad experience in dealing with France in the past on nuclear dealings, and they did not want them to be there. Secondly, the Iranians make the argument that this amount of details would put the risk primarily on Iran's shoulder, because the Iranians would give up 75% of their LEU and they wouldn't get anything back until a year later. A lot could happen during that year. What are the guarantees that the Iranians would have that the West would not walk out of the deal? Well, it wouldn't renege on the deal, and particularly with France's involvement. And for several days, for 2 days in addition, they go back and forth. The Iranians have a proposal saying that instead of having all of the 1,200 kilos sent out immediately, they should be sent out in two or three shipments. For every shipment that they send out LEU, they would instantaneously get fuel pads back. That way, the risk in their argument would be more evenly distributed. That was not acceptable to the United States. First of all, because there was a need to make sure that the Iranians were well below 1,200 kilos. If you took out 400 kilos, which would be a third of the shipment, the Iranians would be at 1,100. And within a couple of months, they would be above 1,200 again. So it didn't seem to have, it wouldn't meet what the U.S. needed in order to create more political space for itself. The other aspect of it, though, was a technical impossibility. These fuel pads, you can't find them at Kmart. There's only one reactor of this kind in the world, and that's the Iranian one. There's no one else using the type of fuel pads that that reactor needed. So it would take quite some time to actually producing it. So it wasn't a feasible proposal from the American perspective. By the end of the third day, the two sides had essentially not changed their positions. This was not so much a negotiation as it was an exchange of ultimatums. And El Baradei realizes that he's looking at failure. But instead of accepting failure, he gives a suggestion that they will have a gentleman's agreement to go and tell the media that they had constructive talks and we're going to take back the proposals back to their respective capitals, and within 3 days a formal response would be given whether they accept or not accept. Immediately, Russia, France, and the U.S. accept the deal, which is not that difficult because the deal they accepted was their own deal. So that's pretty straightforward. The Iranians, however, do not say yes, nor do they say no. Time passes, and instead of actually coming back with a rejection or an acceptance, they make requests for additional meetings at the technical level to hash out the differences, and the key issue for them was a guarantee that the West would not renege on the deal. It was clear, though, by mid-November, that this round of diplomacy had failed. 11 months of the president's time had passed, and he had nothing to show for it. We know, and the administration knew at the time, that the key reason why the Iranians didn't accept was not necessarily because of their arguments, even though their arguments could have been valid, was because of political infighting in Iran that made it impossible for the Iranians to essentially come to a yes. And the administration knew that there was a risk of this because the political chaos continued to exist, but they had no choice in their view than to try it at least. By end of November, the president decides to activate the pressure track, as it was called, and pursue sanctions in the Security Council in order to punish the Iranians for not having agreed to the fuel swap. The hope was that within 2 or so months, the Security Council would unite around a new, very, very tough Security Council resolution. And by sometime in February, it would be passed by the Security Council. It didn't work out that way. Significant resistance from both Russia and China, who did not want to go for more sanctions, who were still hoping that some additional diplomatic effort could be made. And time passes. March comes, April comes, no prospects of an agreement on sanctions. And the administration starts to feel really worried. They have pressure, particularly from Congress, who wanted to pass their own sanctions. But congressional sanctions would have not just targeted Iran, would actually have targeted some of the US's allies in the Security Council. And the administration keeps on telling Congress, do not pass any unilateral sanctions until we have first passed sanctions at the UN Security Council. Congress says, okay, but do it fast. But the administration cannot do it fast because there's so much resistance. By May, there start to be some signs that there's an opening. But at that point, two other countries in the Security Council decide that they want to give it a shot. They want to see if they can get the Iranians to say yes to the deal. Turkey and Brazil, two countries that were non-permanent members of the Security Council, take on their own diplomacy in coordination with the US and try to change things. Both of them have a stake in this issue. Turkey, as a neighbor of Iran, who would suffer tremendously if there were both sanctions, particularly if there were war. Brazil has its own nuclear program and has various reasons to be involved in this as well. On May 16th, the president of Brazil, Lula, travels to Iran. The day after, Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey joins him. They have an 18-hour marathon negotiation with the Iranians. Very tense negotiations at times. I sat down with the negotiators and they describe what happened. It's quite an interesting thing and I describe it in detail in the book. But at the end of it, they actually get a yes from the Iranians. And the Iranians put their signature on the agreement that follows the same benchmarks as the previous American proposal. 1,200 kilos of LEU would be shipped out in one shipment and the Iranians would get the fuel pads back a year later. The difference was the Iranian LEU would be put in Turkey in an escrow account, and the fuel pads would be produced by Russian LEU. And if the West reneged on the deal, the Iranians could go to Turkey and get their LEU back. It was actually a proposal that Obama himself had endorsed during the April nuclear summit in Washington, D.C., in conversation with Erdogan and with Lula. The Brazilians and the Turks are ecstatic. They've managed to resolve a major nuclear dispute, at least an opening stage of it, something that the Europeans had failed to do for several years, and they had now shown that these two rising powers have an ability to resolve international disputes. Amorim, the Brazilian foreign minister, traveled to Turkey and after that immediately, I think, to Portugal, call Secretary Clinton, ecstatic, explaining the details of the deal, hoping that this would resolve and, of course, be quite pleasing to the administration. To his shock, Secretary Clinton is not happy at all and explains to him that the deal will not be accepted by the United States. 2 days later, in a Senate testimony, Secretary Clinton says that we have now decided to go forward with sanctions in the Security Council. And she says this is our clearest answer to the developments of the past weekend, referring to the negotiations in Tehran. Why? Because Lula and Erdogan did not know that the day before he arrived in Tehran, Russia and China had agreed to a sanctions draft in the Security Council. And as a result, the administration is presented with an option of either going forward with the sanctions or going forward with a nuclear breakthrough. And the choice is to go forward with the sanctions. Now, there are differences in the deals, however. The administration presents publicly that now the Iranians actually were having 2,400 kilos of LEU. If you take out 1,200, they still have 1,200 left. They made the argument that this deal had expired. It needed to be updated in order for it to be accepted. Moreover, the Iranians had started advanced enrichment at the 20% level, which the deal did not address. And a lot of criticism is expressed both against Erdogan and Lula, to the extent that someone in Lula's office or somewhere in the Brazilian government, in Brasilia, gets a little bit tired of the criticism and releases a letter that had been sent by President Obama to the President of Brazil on April 20th, only 3.5 weeks before he went to Tehran. In that letter, President Obama asks Lula to get 1,200 kilos of LEU out of Iran, put it in an escrow account in Turkey, and the Iranians would get their fuel pads back in a year, and that this would be a significant confidence-building measure and tremendously important to the U.S.'s national security interest. There was no mention in the letter signed by the president that there was a need to bring out more LEU because the Iranian LEU count had changed. Nor was there any mention in the letter that the Iranians had now advanced enrichment to the 20% level. Quite a lot of tensions emerged between Brazil and Turkey and the U.S. over this issue, because the Brazilians and the Turks believed that they had followed the letter point by point and delivered what the president wanted them to deliver. In fact, at one point in the negotiations, the Turks showed the letter to the Iranians to convince the Iranians to agree to the deal, saying, if you agree to the deal, we already know the U.S. is going to agree to it. They didn't turn out that way. So now, why did Obama choose sanctions over the nuclear opening that the deal could have presented? It's a complicated issue. One of it is that when you go for sanctions and you manage, you spend 5-6 months of your diplomatic capital to get all countries on board, even if you actually manage to get the deal you wanted, the momentum of the sanctions are so great that you may end up going for that anyways. But the most important thing, however, was that the administration felt that they had completely run out of political space. Congress was pushing for sanctions, and if they had gone with the nuclear opening, the diplomatic breakthrough, Congress would have itself gone forward with their sanctions because of all the pressure that Congress was under. And this would have created a major rift between the states and the P5. And in many ways, you see when you follow these negotiations and you talk to the diplomats that the Iran issue in a way became secondary. It became the organizing principle for alliance management within the Security Council. And if they had gone for the breakthrough, the consensus would have broken. Congress would have acted in a certain way, and the U.S. would have dealt with a situation in which the Iranians could have taken advantage of the differences within the P5, and as a result, the U.S. would be put in a much more difficult situation. And remember, this is just a couple of months before the congressional midterm elections. The administration really felt they had no political space left, and as a result, they went to this. What is so sad about this, though, is that it showed that this pattern of missed opportunities between Iran and the United States continued, and in fact intensified. The Iranians missed several opportunities back in the late 1990s when the Clinton administration did some outreach. The Bush administration missed some opportunities in the early 2003-2001 period. But rarely have two opportunities been so close to each other in which both of them, first Iran in October 2009 and then later on the United States in May 2010, have missed it. And this does create a significant problem, because at the end of the day, we are now 3 years into this, closer to a military confrontation. We have adopted more and more sanctions on the Iranians. Those sanctions have been quite devastating for the Iranian economy. The Iranians are definitely feeling the pressure. This is more pressure than they have ever been under before. But we have seen no signs whatsoever yet that they are willing to change their calculation on the nuclear program or to have a more flexible position in the negotiations as a result of the sanctions. And one of the things that happen when you're in this type of a conflict dynamic that is so dangerous is that both sides are trying to hurt the other as much as they possibly can, even if it means that they also inflict some pain on themselves. And as you go deeper and deeper into that conflict dynamic, every new escalatory step appears to you to be even more justified and even more logical because the other side just did this other thing. And before you know it, it's not the governments controlling the dynamics. It's the dynamics controlling the governments. And you may end up in a military confrontation, even though that was never necessarily the intent. In fact, this is one of the things that Admiral Mike Mullen warned about right before he left office this past summer. He's the former chief of the Joint Chief of Staff, chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff. And he said, we have no communication, proper communication with the Iranians. As a result, we misunderstand each other. When you misunderstand, you miscalculate. When you miscalculate, you escalate. And without these de-escalatory mechanisms, you end up in a situation in which an accident can spark a much, much larger conflict. I think the Obama administration is very concerned about that right now. It's part of the reason why they're trying to de-escalate, trying to find a way back to the negotiating table. But it's happening at a time in which the stakes are ever high as they've been, but the flexibility is at its minimum because we have elections in the United States in a couple of months. The Iranians have parliamentary elections next month. So the prospect for success is unfortunately not very good, and particularly not if there isn't a much more aggressive effort on both sides domestically to fight for the political space that they need in order to succeed. This is the key mistake in my assessment that the administration did. Its strategy was consistently to try to adjust to the existing political landscape that existed rather than trying to expand it by standing up and fighting for their policy. And an enmity of 30 years cannot be resolved by adjusting to a strategy, by pursuing a strategy that is adjusting to the very same political landscape that gave birth to the problem and the enmity and that has perpetuated it for three decades. As one Obama administration official told me when I interviewed him, he said that our diplomacy and our policy became a gamble on a single roll of the dice, hence the title of the book. It either had to work right away or not at all. And very seldomly has diplomacy worked in that instantaneous fashion. Thank you so much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council. He was recorded speaking at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on February 10th. Following his talk entitled A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, Dr. Parsi responded to questions from the audience.
So, Dr. Parsi, thank you very much for an excellent presentation. The situation that you describe at the end, as a professor of East Asian history, I cannot help but note, sounds very similar to the summer of 1941, when the United States imposed a series of severe economic sanctions on Imperial Japan with the notion that, in the end, it would see reason, air quotes, and yet they chose the path of unreason, air quotes again. One of the reasons they did that was that the leadership on the Japanese side was united in the notion that to accept the American proposals was essentially to embrace national destruction. Which brings up the question of unity of leadership. There is, in fact, some profound tension, is there not, within the upper reaches of the Iranian leadership, and could you talk about it, please?
Yes, absolutely, and I think you're quite right. And I think this has been a major challenge for the administration, part of the reason why there wasn't necessarily the appetite to try to fight for more political space was because there's so much of this that is not under the control of the United States. if there's political chaos over there and the administration were to take a gamble and try to fight for more political space in order to pursue diplomacy, what if all of that would fall flat because the Iranians were still embroiled in this literal war against themselves at the elite level? So there are several different factors that cause this timidity at the end of the day. And it is something that is continuing. Right now, you have a process in Iran over the last couple of years in which the Iranian political spectrum has shifted far, far to the right and become much, much more narrow. The elements that are now at the table in Iran making decisions, particularly on foreign policy, tend to be far, far fewer and far more hardline than they were just 10 years ago. And this is making diplomacy much more difficult as well. You have a much more confrontational posture by the other side. You also have, in many ways, a more, I would say, desperate mentality on the other side. I don't think it is quite reasonable to expect that if you put massive pressure on an entity and leave it almost with no way out, that suddenly that would cause them to be more reasonable. In fact, there are about 10 cases historically of massive embargoes imposed on other countries for the purpose of getting significant changes in their policies. Out of those 10 cases, only one of them actually led to a situation in which they capitulated their nuclear program and turned in a democratic direction. In all of the other 9, they have either, in the case of North Korea, potentially averted war by testing a bomb. In the case of Iraq, not really giving up their program, but ended up being invaded. And in the other ones, getting a more repressive, more undemocratic, more dangerous, more destabilizing regime than it was before. And in the case of Iran, I would say that if this current policy path continues and it doesn't lead to a confrontation, I would believe that the most likely outcome is the next worst outcome. And that is that 5 to 10 years from now, we would have a more repressive, more undemocratic, more destabilizing, more dangerous Iran with a nuclear weapon.
I thought that there was an earlier outreach by Iran with Ahmadinejad's letter of congratulations to Obama when he was first elected. And, of course, Ahmadinejad couldn't put that out without an okay from Khamenei as far as they would have looked at it. And it seemed to me when I'm remembering back on the letter, there were some good openings there. And wouldn't that have, it didn't really spark anything. We seemed to have just dropped the ball there. Isn't that what happened?
Actually, my understanding is that letter was written without the Supreme Leader's knowledge or consent. It's one of the characteristics of Ahmadinejad that sets him apart from previous presidents in Iran, which is that he just goes ahead and does whatever he wants without necessarily clearing it. Part of the reason why there is so much tension between the two of them right now as well. He sent that congratulation letter. It was unprecedented. And in the Iranian mindset, that was a huge outreach, etc. The president didn't respond, and he was asked about it a day or 2 days later at a press conference. He didn't address the question. He said that Iran with a nuclear weapon is unacceptable. And that was viewed by the Ahmadinejad camp as quite a strong rebuff. But I think, to be frank with you, the president's tactic from the very outset was to try to engage the Iranians without having to directly engage with Ahmadinejad, because of the political sensitivity about him and particularly his rhetoric against Israel, against the Holocaust that has caused in Washington. So whereas, for instance, when Obama went to one of the meetings, I think it was at the UN, there was this bizarre photo op between him and Chavez of Venezuela. When he went to the UN in 2009 to speak, a lot of preparations were being made to make sure that the schedule of Ahmadinejad and the schedule of Obama would never end up being compatible so that they would walk by each other in the hall or anything like that. Because that's a photo op the president simply did not want to have.
I'm sorry, I have to talk Farsi because my English is not good. So someone probably, or Mr. Farsi, can go.
There's an Iranian in Alaska? Oh my God.
با درود آقای پارسی، خسته نباشید. می‌خواستم بدونم که طی این 30 سال گذشته با تمام روابط دیپلماسی که بین کشورهای مختلف و ایران بوده هیچ نتیجه نبوده چون این حکومت ایران هیچ شفاف نبوده با دنیای خارج از خودش. و اینکه می‌خواستم بدونم که به نظر شما، یعنی خودم می‌خواستم بدونم که آیا شما نظرت اصلاح طلبان داخل ایران رو که همانا حفظ کردن منافع حکومت اسلامیه دنبال میکنین و یا منافع ملت ایران رو، چون که خودتون بهتر میدونین که طی این 30 سال گذشته ملت ایران خواهان عوض شدن حکومت ایران هستن تا کنار اومدن باهاش، و یا اینکه میخواستم بدونم که به نظر شما کنار اومدن با حکومتی که طی این 30 سال گذشته ناقض حقوق بشر بوده آیا منطقیه؟ ممنون.
خیلی ممنونم. I'm going to translate your question. I got to say, I'm shocked seeing another Iranian in Alaska. So he asked a very important question, saying some premises I don't agree with, some premises I agree with. His question is that in the last 30 years, dealings of the outside world with the Iranian government have not been successful, and they've certainly not been transparent. And the question is, those different elements, even the more moderate elements, the reformists in Iran, are they pursuing their own interests? Are they pursuing the national interests of Iran? Most of the people in Iran, and this I do agree with, want to see a different government in Iran. In respect to that, and in respect to the fact that this is a government that commits tremendous abuses on human rights on many, many different levels, is it logical to sit down and negotiate with such a regime? Or is it, I would assume, illogical, would create more problems if one were to do so? That's the question. My answer would be, first of all, I think there have been successful negotiations in the past. I think the US and Iran have had far greater difficulties in doing so. But the question is extremely important, because there is a perception, as I mentioned earlier on, part of the ideology of the Obama administration, but also amongst many people in Iran, I don't know if it's a majority or not, a fear that if the United States were to negotiate with the regime in Iran, an unpopular regime, a human rights abusing regime in Iran, that that would secure the survival of that regime, and that the population would not like to see such a development, of course. And this perception is born out of experience. It's not taken out of empty air, because at the end of the day, during the time of the Shah, the United States had very good relations with Iran, and the perception amongst a lot of people in Iran was that this regime of the Shah survived to a large part because of its relations with the United States. And the United States, within the context of the Cold War, at times turned a blind eye to the human rights abuses of the Shah because it was too important to keep Iran strong under the Shah as an ally against the Soviet Union. And as a result of this, this is a common fear, and I think an understandable fear. I have a different view. I understand the perception of this, but in my assessment, the legitimacy that the Iranian government needs, and that it to a very large extent lacks, is the legitimacy that only the people of Iran can give its own regime. The United States, even if it wanted to, does not have the ability to legitimize a foreign government in the eyes of its own people. And the lack of legitimacy that the Iranian government, in my assessment, suffers from is not going to be resolved in any direction, whether there is a resolution to the US-Iran tensions or not. In fact, if you just take a look at the Libyan case, exactly a year before the US and NATO went in to first officially create a no-fly zone, but eventually, of course, became a regime change campaign against Gaddafi. Exactly a year before, 3 U.S. senators visited Gaddafi. Those were Senator McCain, Senator Lieberman, and Senator Lindsey. In those conversations, as a result of the WikiLeaks, you see that they even offered Gaddafi military assistance and support to get through some military deals in Congress and in the Senate. About a year earlier than that, Gaddafi had been invited and was given the red carpet in Paris. He had also been invited by Gordon Brown in England, but for some reason, I guess Gaddafi was too busy to show up there. None of these things mattered a bit when the Libyan people themselves decided that enough was enough and they did not want to have anything to do with this dictator. It didn't lend them any legitimacy, didn't lend them any support. Once the people decided that Gaddafi had to go, it did not matter which red carpet in any foreign country that he had walked on. Now, I would make this argument that the same is true for Iran. Doesn't matter which government that were to deal with the government in Iran, the lack of legitimacy, the opposition to the regime inside of Iran is born not because he has this relationship or doesn't have this relationship with a foreign country. It's because of the lack of freedoms, the repression of religious and ethnic minorities. It's because of the corruption. It's because of the incompetence. And it's because this regime has not been able to bring Iran to the potential that it deserves. To think that the United States could save this regime is to both defy recent history, but also to have perhaps some magical traits of the U.S. government, which I, frankly, living in Washington, D.C., do not see any of. But moreover, in order to minimize even the risk of this, I think it's important that in a comprehensive negotiation with Iran, we should not just talk about the nuclear issue. We should talk about a whole host of issues, from Afghanistan, Iraq, regional security, but also about the human rights situation, precisely because of this perception that exists among some of the population in Iran. Because we should not strike a deal with any government, particularly the government in Iran, in which the people of that country would be left with the perception that we have sold out their rights in that process. By making sure that human rights is part of the agenda, I think we can minimize the risk of that. And one of the things that I was a bit disappointed with what the Obama administration did was that they did not give sufficient attention to the human rights situation in that country. Are we done?
We're done.
Okay, all right. Thank you all so much. Really appreciate it.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Trita Parsi, President of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Dr. Parsi's talk on Obama's diplomacy with Iran was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on February 10, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening. Did you know that you can listen to Alaska World Affairs Council luncheons on alaskapublic.org? To find out more about the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents podcast, just click on Podcasts at the bottom of alaskapublic.org.